Good morning. I gather I'm supposed to introduce myself, so here I am. My name is Tad Homer Dixon from the University of Toronto. I run the Trudeau Center in Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Toronto. I'm a professor in the political science department there. And my work focuses on the relationship between environment and society, and especially how societies adapt to all kinds of complex stress of various kinds. It's really a delight to be here today. I haven't been to the Aspen Institute in 6 years. In fact, I spent a couple of wonderful days here 6 years ago, almost exactly 6 years ago, in this room, talking about, in part, the relationship between environmental stress and violence in developing countries. That's not the topic that I'm going to address today. I should say I feel actually quite out of place. I think I'm the only person wearing a tie in the entire constituency. I'll take it off when I sit down. Because I'm going to do two parts of this presentation. One up here, if I sit there while I've got slides, I'm going to have to turn around too much. So I'm going to stand here, and then I'll sit down at the table, and we can have a chat about some of the things I say. I'll take my tie off then, but only my tie. So the topic today is pretty basic, stated very simply. What do we do about climate change? And since this image is going to be up for a while, I'm going to explain briefly what you're looking at here. And this is sort of the empirical or existential backdrop of our conversation today. This is a slide of aggregated satellite data from February 2006, this past February, showing temperature anomalies around the world against a baseline of temperature from 1951 to 1980. So for each place in the world, the average temperature was calculated, surface temperature was calculated from 1951 to 1980. And what you're seeing here, the colors indicate anomalous warming or cooling relative to that average at that particular place. It's pretty clear what the situation is. Here we have from minus 8 degrees to plus 8 degrees Celsius. I should note this is Celsius, so we're talking about roughly from minus 16 to plus 16 degrees Fahrenheit. And you can see the impact of global warming in the northern hemisphere. In particular, you can see that Canada was really cooking. This past February, we had the warmest... Did I just do something? I'm having a catastrophic technological failure here.
I think you just wanted to hibernate.
Is it going to do that again? Will it do that again?
No.
So we were really cooking in Canada. This past winter, we had the warmest winter in history in Canada, in Ontario especially. It was remarkable. It was like we had no winter. With all kinds of downstream effects in terms of the water available and water tables, effects on plants, flora and fauna, insect proliferation during the summer and things like that. Notice two significant warm spots here, but also really quite cold in Europe, and that there were instances of collapsed buildings in Germany, Poland, and Moscow from heavy snow loads on roofs. You probably remember those. I'll talk a little bit more about the possibility in the future that while much of the northern hemisphere gets warmer, Europe might actually get colder for a while. And why that is possible. It's not clear that that's already happening. This may be just a fluke, but it's a suggestion of what we might be seeing in the future. The question of what we can do about climate change is it's a simple question, but the answer is horribly complex. Of necessity, it's horribly complex. Do we try to stop this process, this warming process? we try to reduce carbon dioxide outputs, or there might be other technologies, various kinds of geoengineering, putting mirrors in space or increasing the reflectivity of the atmosphere that will actually reduce the warming process. Do we decide that ultimately there's not much we can do, at least about some a fair amount of warming, and so what we need to do instead is adapt to the changes that are coming our way, the environmental changes? And if we adapt, if we decide at least some of our response is going to be adaptation and adjustment to the effects of climate change, then there are a whole bunch of things we can do or decisions we have to make about what we're going to do. We can introduce new technologies of various kinds, technologies in the energy sector, in the transport sector, in housing, in food production, all of which will have significant implications for climate change. Just about every technology we use, in actual fact, will have to be adjusted in some respect if we're going to reduce, for instance, our output of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. More fundamentally, and probably more importantly, are we going to have to change, and how will we change our institutions? For instance, our markets and the pricing of goods like energy within our markets. Right at the moment, our energy pricing is not, as economists would say, internalizing externalities. Our prices don't reflect long-term costs to our society, to our children, and to our grandchildren. Our gasoline, for instance, is far too cheap. If we really want to inspire entrepreneurs and encourage innovation, technological and other kinds of innovation to reduce carbon dioxide output, there are other kinds of institutional changes that we can introduce. For instance, we can start carbon trading, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later, using emission permits. We might even consider changes in our political systems. I would say that especially in the United States, but also in Canada and in many countries around the world, our political systems seem to be woefully inadequate in dealing with the challenge of climate change. Our time horizons are too short. This is a problem that goes out for a decade, two decades, generations, even a millennia into the future, a millennium. The warming that we've already introduced through our greenhouse gases into the global environment, and the warming that will come from the greenhouse gases we've already put into the atmosphere, will not have its full environmental effect for almost 1,000 years from now. And the longest lag times are with sea level rise. So we're already committed to very substantial changes, and yet our political systems have 4-year time horizons. Now, one change we could think about making, not one that I'll discuss today, is introducing political institutions that represent future generations or that represent other organisms on this planet who are going to be affected very substantially by climate change. And fundamentally, our political systems are hidebound because they're largely beholden to special interests of various kinds, especially in the energy and transportation sectors, that have, I think, fundamentally prevented a thorough discussion of climate change and a thorough discussion of the policies that we might use to deal with climate change. Now, how are we going to make our political systems more nimble, more mobile, more flexible in the face of these very powerful interests that are restricting our adaptation? Now, those are really big questions, and each one, I could spend a day talking about each one of those. Perhaps most fundamentally, what we need to think about is how we might change our lifestyles. And if we're thinking about changing our lifestyles, then we have to at least consider the possibility of changing our values, what it is that we regard as important in our lives in terms of our consumption, in terms of our expectations for our children and our grandchildren. Kind of meaningful worlds do we want people, ourselves and our and the people we care about, to live within in coming generations? And these are fundamentally value-based or moral questions. And those are very complex, too. And we could make changes in all of these areas. I'll talk just about a few of them today. My aim is to break this horribly complex problem apart, to analyze it, so we can see its components more effectively and make the whole thing more tractable. If you come away from my presentation today and from our conversation with five or so clear ideas about what we might be able to do and the challenges we face, and I think that will be a success. So the rest of my brief talk is going to be broken into three parts. First of all, I'm going to talk about what we mean by problem solving. And in that, I'm going to introduce what I call ingenuity theory, which is something I've been working on for well over a decade, which is a way of thinking about how our problems are becoming more complex and our capacity to deliver responses effectively to those problems. Secondly, I'm going to talk about some of the key characteristics or features of climate change that make it a particularly difficult problem for us. The title of this is that climate change is our greatest ingenuity challenge. And I think that really is the case. This is a make or break challenge for the human species and for each one of the societies around the world today. And it's easily going to be the most complex problem in terms of our values, in terms of our institutions, in terms of our technologies that humankind has ever had to address. And then finally, I'm going to focus on four interventions that I think would make a big difference in dealing with the problem of climate change. And these are interventions that we could start right now. So let's begin with a somewhat abstract but I think useful way of thinking about what problems are, how we can approach the issue of problem solving. Now, I call my approach ingenuity theory, and it's grounded in an idea of ingenuity, which I define quite specifically as sets of instructions that allow us to manipulate the materials in our world and perhaps the people in our world in ways that can help us solve our problems. So ingenuity consists essentially of recipes, like cooking recipes that we would use in our kitchen, for example. And I focus on our ability to supply these recipes, these sets of instructions, in the places when and where we need them. Now, my idea fundamentally is that we take the stuff from our world, the raw materials from our world, and by following very complex recipes, we produce just about everything we see, all the artifacts we see around us today. This laptop computer, for example, has about as much computational power as was available to the entire American Defense Department in the 1960s. In those days, it would have taken up a building about the size of the Pentagon, and here it is in a box that's about 4 liters in volume right now. Now, this laptop computer consists of nothing more, ultimately, than reconfigured rock and hydrocarbons. We've taken that raw material out of the ground and we've processed it following an almost infinitely long set of instructions to produce devices like this laptop. And that's true for everything we see around us in this room right here. And that is my fundamental focus. Whereas mainstream economists, when they talk about the production of goods and services in our societies and, to a certain extent, our problem-solving ability, focus on inputs of labor and capital and perhaps resources into our production processes. I focus on inputs of ideas, of innovation, or of what I call ingenuity. And I try to track what are the factors that affect our requirement for that ingenuity and what are the factors that affect our ability to supply that ingenuity. So if I'm going to state my thesis in one sentence, this is the elevator pitch version, human beings use ingenuity to guide the application of energy to arrange the matter around them, including materials and people, in ways that they hope will solve their problems. Now, I can elaborate on this idea for a long time. In fact, I wrote a whole book about it called The Ingenuity Gap, which unfortunately I see is not available in the bookstore, even though it's still in print in the United States. But I'm just going to give you a very quick introduction to some of this idea today. One very important distinction is between technical and social ingenuity, sets of instructions that allow us to produce things like this laptop computer, this which is technical ingenuity, and sets of instructions that allow us to, that tell us how to organize ourselves. I talked about, remember, manipulating people. You put quotation marks around manipulation there. But how do we organize ourselves in our groups, in our firms, in our societies, internationally so that we can effectively deal with problems like climate change. Now, I argue that human beings are very good at technical ingenuity, at producing large quantities of technical ingenuity, but it turns out we're not so good at producing the amount of social ingenuity when and where we need it. And yet social ingenuity ultimately is probably more important than technical ingenuity. The deepest responses to a problem like climate change are going to be the most fundamental and ultimately the most important. The ones that are going to get us closest to actually dealing with the problem are going to be social responses. They're going to be institutional responses. They might be value-based responses. And they're the ones that we are ultimately considering the least and that we are furthest behind on when we address the problem of climate change. In fact, I'll go even further. We don't get technical solutions to our problems until we get our social institutions organized the right way. Something like this laptop wouldn't have been invented, it wouldn't have been developed, and wouldn't have been produced if we hadn't had our markets organized in a particular way to provide entrepreneurs with the incentives to protect them against catastrophic risk so that they would ultimately take the risk of going ahead and inventing and producing the machine. And yet markets are phenomenally complex institutions that require a host of regulations and norms and rules, from property rights to banking systems to police and court systems that enforce contracts to limited liability legislation, and you can go on and on. All of these things are essential. And by the way, all of these things require almost always some kind of state involvement, some kind of governmental involvement to produce public goods. All of these things are essential for the development of the technical ingenuity that we need to address something like climate change. So I want to move back from a place where a lot of us feel quite comfortable, and I'll talk a bit more about technical ingenuity in a minute, but that's a place where we feel comfortable. But I want to say that ultimately we need to move back to looking at social solutions to a complex environmental problem and what are the impediments to developing those social solutions. Now, I see the challenge that we face as a species in these terms, that in some ways our requirement for ingenuity is rising much faster than our ability to supply it. That's not in every domain of human activity, but with respect to some of the challenges we're creating for ourselves, and I would say climate change is one of them, we're creating problems faster and that are harder than we can solve. And that leaves what I call an ingenuity gap. Now, something that's important to notice about the way I've drawn this almost sort of metaphorical schema here is that the supply of ingenuity is still rising. This is not an argument about limits to science or limits to innovation or inventiveness on the part of human beings. I think that we remain unbelievably creative creatures. But we're not driving up our supply of ingenuity as fast as it needs to be driven up in order to deal with our climate change problem. The other thing I want to point out is that when I talk about the supply of ingenuity, I'm not just talking about new ideas developed. I'm talking about them implemented too. So the institutions and technologies that we develop to deal with climate change actually have to be out there in the field, implemented and operating before I consider them to be supplied. And that's actually where we run into a lot of problems. Because it turns out that there are actually a lot of very good ideas for dealing with the climate change problem out there. But getting them into place, getting things like carbon trading, cap and trade institutions into place for climate change, turns out to be phenomenally difficult, in large part because of those special interests that I talked about earlier that act to block various kinds of social innovations. So that's the background of what I call ingenuity theory, how we can think about our problems, and in particular climate change. Let's talk a little bit about climate change itself and why there are some characteristics or features of climate change that make it probably the most difficult challenge that human beings have ever faced, maybe will ever face. There are actually four things I want to talk about with respect to climate change, and these are three of them. Some climate change is going to be nonlinear, extreme events will become more frequent, and climate change is going to interact synergistically with other stresses. But I'm actually going to start with something more fundamental, and that is the magnitude of the change we're facing, the momentum of our output of greenhouse gases, and the rate of the change as it seems to be occurring right now. Now, those of you who attended Bill Clinton's presentation last night heard him say that in the last 10 years or so, or at least since he left office, he has recognized that this problem is much worse than he realized at the time he was in office. And that's probably the case. In fact, in 2005, there was a flood of papers on climate change that came out that suggested we have a much more serious and much more imminent problem than we thought. If there was a tipping point in the scientific establishment's appreciation of the criticality of this issue, it was probably 2005. In probably half a dozen or 10 different domains of scientific research relating to climate change, there were significant advances in our understanding of the problem and data on how rapidly climate is actually changing. Let me tell you a little bit about what some of this stuff looks like, some of these data look like. First of all, let's go to the Antarctic. Let's go to a frozen lake in Antarctic called Vostok, Lake Vostok. Over a long period of time, now going back almost 40 years, scientists have taken an ice core out of this frozen lake. Now, the Great Antarctic Ice Sheet is basically an accumulated record of past climates. The ice sheet has been created by snow that has fallen over millennia. Each layer of snow that falls every year is compacted and compressed under other layers. And there are tiny air bubbles in there that can be tested and examined, and you can determine what the carbon dioxide concentration was at the time that the snow fell, more or less. I'm simplifying the story a bit, but it's good enough for now. And this ice sheet is some 4 kilometers thick, and so you can take a 4-kilometer-long ice core out of the ice sheet, and you're essentially going back in time as you go down that ice core. The drilling was started by the Russians, or the Soviets, in the 1970s with help from the French, and it was continued by Americans in the 1990s. And now we have a record going back some 650,000 years. This shows about 420,000 years of this record. Now, those of you who have seen An Inconvenient Truth, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm almost positive that Al Gore presents these Vostok data. He does, I assume, doesn't he? Yeah. Because this, what I'm doing right now, I saw Al use at one of his presentations. And it was very effective, so I decided I would use that in my presentations. So very quickly, what are we seeing here? The black line there is CO2 concentration. You read that off the right axis from 0 to 600 parts per million by volume. And the blue line here is temperature, and you read that off the left axis from minus 15 to plus 30 degrees Celsius. The zero here actually represents minus 55 degrees Celsius, as you can see from here, 55.5 degrees Celsius. It's basically the temperature at the time the ice core was extracted from the ice in the 1980s, the prevailing temperature at that time. And this is the present here, going back then 420,000 years into the past. The first thing you notice, of course, is a very close correlation between changes in CO2 concentration and changes in temperature. Now, that's not proof that there is a causal relationship between the two things, let alone a causal relationship in one direction or the other. You know, correlation does not mean causation. But as lawyers would say, it's pretty good prima facie evidence that there's some kind of relationship here. And there's been a lot of investigation as to what actually has caused these two things, these two very different variables, to cycle in such close correlation with each other. The second thing that you notice, of course, is right here, this rising, very rapidly rising CO2 concentration. We've increased since the Industrial Revolution concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere from about 280 parts per million to around 375 parts per million right now. And because that's been in such a short period of time in terms of the time scale of this graph here, it looks like it's happening almost instantaneously. The line increases vertically. Now, that's where we are right at the moment. Where are we going? And this is what Al Gore did in the presentation I saw at Dartmouth many years ago. He said, simply said that this is what we're going to see almost certainly within the lifetimes of our children and grandchildren. We will see a doubling of pre-industrial CO2 concentrations that's anticipated by around 2060, 2070. And it will continue very likely after that if we continue with business as usual, especially the kind of development trajectories we're seeing in India and China right now. And those countries are emitting huge amounts of carbon dioxide. Now, at the moment, almost all of our climate models are correlated to 2 times CO2, a doubling of pre-industrial levels, which would come in, if this is the pre-industrial level right here, then a doubling of CO2 is about in here somewhere.
Which is 2050
to 2070. Yep. A lot of people are starting to recognize now that it's unlikely that, given the way things seem to be going, and unless we wake up very soon, it's unlikely we're going to stop at a doubling and we may go to a tripling or a quadrupling of carbon dioxide within the next 1.5 centuries or so. And then we would see this line literally go through the roof. This is a very, very fundamental change in one of the basic constituents of our atmosphere and the planet. And we can expect that the blue line, all our physics tells us, that the blue line will start to increase too. In fact, if you look at over the last century, it appears that the temperature has already gone up by somewhere between 0.6 and 0.7 degrees Celsius. Right at the moment, carbon dioxide concentrations are increasing at 2 to 2.5 parts per million by volume each year. That rate has increased in the last 4 years. The average was around 1.6 until about 1998 or 2000 or so. Since the year 2000, it seems to have jumped. We're not exactly sure why, but it may have something to do with the declining absorptive capacity of certain biota like forests or maybe the oceans on the planet. So it looks like our rate of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere is increasing. The Vostok data now go back 650,000 years, and it's been determined that we are now well outside the envelope of CO2 concentrations that occurred any time in that 650,000 years. That we saw a cycling between 180 and 280 up to recently, and now we're already at 360. Yep. So that's here, for example. So that's the last. Yeah, 1, 2, 3, right there, right? Well, there probably it's got mostly to do with cycles of solar radiation, in particular the relationship between the sun and the Earth and changes in orbital parameters, how much like an elliptic, I can't get the word right, elliptitudinous or something like that, eccentricity, thank you, of the Earth's orbit, the tilt of the Earth's axis, the speed of precession of the Earth's axis around that, around the tilt around the...
It looks like there's a periodicity of about 100,000 years between those last three peaks.
That's right.
These
orbital cycles are considered to be the explanations for each one of those spikes, the initial explanation. But what happens then on the planet in response to those changes in solar radiation is a complex process. And somehow there may be a change in carbon dioxide concentration that interacts with the change in solar radiation to produce the increase in temperature. So the first thing that happens is a change in the orbital parameters, it's believed. And then you get a change in perhaps vegetation on the surface of the planet, the weathering of rocks, introduction of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and then subsequently a change in temperature. The big question on the part of the skeptics right now is whether solar radiation, changes in solar radiation, are causing the warming that we've seen. And that is a very significant debate. On balance, it seems that the warming, and this is the conclusion that's been reached by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that the warming we've seen in the last century is largely due to changes in concentrations of carbon dioxide. Now, I should say, if you look at the most recent spike here, where we are right now, we're almost as warm as the last interglacial. So there's some suggestion that we may actually reasonably soon be as warm as the last interglacial or even warmer. And so we're going into a range of temperatures that the world hasn't experienced for a long period of time, as you can see. I'm going to take two more questions because I have quite a bit more of my presentation. And I'll take one more of you and then the woman at the back, and then we should get back on track here.
I don't know the literature. Has anyone looked at the possibility of some kind of oscillation in the output of some kind of mechanism in solar output that could have some kind of oscillation that maybe has quit or changed?
There's been a lot of investigation of changes in what's called the solar constant, which is the amount of energy that arrives at the surface of the planet from the sun. Again, the balance of evidence seems to indicate that changes in the solar constant can't explain the recent warming we've seen over the last century and a half, especially the warming that we've seen in the last 10 years, which I was just going to come to. Now, there are people like Sally Baliunas at Harvard University, who say that this is all about changes in the solar constant. But she is now in a small, small minority of scientists. So just to recap, the large, long-term changes in this process that we're seeing are probably due to changes in the relationship between the sun and the earth that affect the amount of solar energy that's received on the surface of the planet. The short-term changes that you see may be related to things like volcanic output, the amount of dust the volcanoes throw into the atmosphere, and changes in the solar constant because of cycles of sunspots and things like that. But none of that stuff can effectively explain the kind of warming that we've seen over the last century. There's a significant residual that's not explained. Does that answer your question from before?
Sure. Thank you.
Okay. Shift in those three things: the eccentricity of the orbit, the tilt of the axis, and the rate of precession of the Earth around the axis. Because these variables, those three variables, are constantly changing. The eccentricity, and thank you by the way for that. The eccentricity of the Earth's orbit is constantly increasing and decreasing. So that means that over a long period of time, over a cycle of hundreds of thousands of years. And so that means that there's a very small but nonetheless important change in the amount of radiation that's received from the sun on the surface of the planet.
So what we need is to hope that there's a shift.
The suggestion, and this would get to the previous question, the suggestion is that under normal circumstances now, we would be heading back into another ice age, that we are at the end of this most recent interglacial. Those interglacials, those three spikes you see, have each lasted only about 10,000 years. We're now well into 10,000, 12,000 years into this interglacial. The suggestion is that under normal circumstances, because of these changes in the parameters of the Earth's orbit, that we would be moving into a colder climate. So one of the arguments on the part of the skeptics about climate change, of course, is, well, actually, we're just stabilizing the climate and keeping it warmer. The problem is that we may actually be forcing it in, as I'll suggest in a moment, we may be forcing it into a climate regime that is very different from anything that's been seen on the planet for a long period of time, that we won't cycle nicely back and forth or stay at a nice, even high temperatures like the previous interglacials, but we'll actually spike up well above that. Okay? I'm going to have to keep going, otherwise there will be no time. Unless we would like to just... Okay. All right. Well, some people seem they do want to know more about climate change.
It's not answered.
Okay. Let's keep going, then. Nonetheless, I assume that there are people here who came for the climate change portion and people here who came for the solutions portion. And it seems like that's the case. So I decided to split my talk in two halves on that. Okay. Now, just to recap a couple of things. So we seem to be outside in terms of carbon dioxide concentration, outside the CO2 band that we've seen for the last 650,000 years. The warming that we're seeing right now, especially over the last 10 years, when we've seen 8 of the 10 warmest years in historical records going back 150 years, but looking at what are called proxy data, which are things like tree rings and sedimentation data and things like that that go back longer, it looks like the warming we're seeing right now is faster than anything that's been experienced in the last 1,000 years at least, maybe even in the last 10,000 years. And it's that rate of change that is particularly significant for the adaptation problem. That's what, if climate change were happening slowly, then you could adjust your institutions and technologies over that long period of time. But if it's happening quickly, everything has more trouble adapting, whether it's our societies or whether it's ecosystems in terms of, you know, plants and animals migrating to places that are cooler as they try to adapt. Fast climate change is much more difficult, a much bigger problem than slow climate change. Okay, now that's all I was going to say about climate change. Not quite. Sorry. I remember I was going to talk about nonlinearity and the other issues, synergy and such, but I'll try to get through these quite quickly. The really significant problem we face from the point of view of climate change is that some of it might be nonlinear. In other words, it's not going to change, temperature is not going to change incrementally over time, but we might see sharp, sudden jumps in the climate. And in fact, some places, as I suggested earlier, might get cooler for a period of time. Now, these are temperature data extracted from the Greenland ice cap. And in this case, they go back only 13,000 years. And what we see here is a jump in temperature, a very significant jump in temperature around 11,000 years ago. That's at the end of the last ice age. It's called the end of the Younger Dryas cold event. On the left axis, you see that they're using a proxy measure for temperature in terms of snow accumulation per year because a warmer atmosphere has higher water vapor content and therefore you have a higher rate of snow accumulation. Now, this jump that we see at the end of the Younger Dryas cold event, it's now widely recognized that that probably represents a 7-degree warming in temperature in a period as short as 10 years. Now, the difference between the last ice age and the current interglacial, the coldest period of the last ice age and the current interglacial, is probably only about 8 degrees Celsius. So that's a very significant change. And this was not just in the North Atlantic, but it looks like this sudden, sharp change in temperature occurred around the planet. That there was a kind of wholesale reorganization of the planet's climate system. We don't know exactly why this is the case, but it's probably got something to do with the Great Ocean Conveyor, which is a cycle of water that goes around the whole planet and is driven largely by water sinking in the North Atlantic. Now, this is the Gulf Stream here, and it comes up and then sinks to the bottom of the ocean. It's a flow about equivalent to about 100 Amazon rivers, and it sinks and then flows back at the bottom of the ocean all the way down and then comes around back into the Pacific and comes to the surface of the ocean and back eventually into the North Atlantic. It takes a long, long time, but it's fundamentally important for the movement of energy between the tropical regions and the poles on the planet. And it depends fundamentally on the sinking of water in the North Atlantic. And you've probably heard something about this. This is called the thermohaline circulation. As the water goes from the equatorial region up to the North Atlantic, the water becomes more saline, and then when it cools in the North Atlantic, it sinks to the bottom of the ocean. And that sinking process is fundamentally influenced by the freshness or the salinity of the water in the North Atlantic. Now, what we're seeing is a significant freshening now of water in the North Atlantic, in particular because of the melting of the Greenland ice cap, which has doubled its rate of melting in the last 10 years from about 90 cubic kilometers to 220 cubic kilometers a year. And much of that fresh water is flooding into this region, which is where we see the sinking that's required to drive the Great Ocean Conveyor. And recent scientific reports last year, in particular, suggest that this flow seems to have reduced its intensity by about 30%. And a few years ago, about 3 years ago, there was a report that said that this flow has reduced its intensity. This is a deep water flow back, has reduced its intensity by about 20%. Now I'm going to just skip ahead a couple of slides here. These are data from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute showing the freshening of water in the North Atlantic from 1960 up to 1995 and 2002. And we see a very substantial freshening between those periods of time. It's considered by some ocean scientists to be the largest change in ocean characteristics that has ever been measured, that freshening of the North Atlantic. Now, whether this is going to produce the kind of nonlinear shift or a breakup of the thermohaline circulation or the Gulf Stream that seems to have influenced sharp climate change in the past, we can't really be sure. There's a general assumption that at some point it will, but that we're some way away from that threshold at this point. But that's one reason those papers from last year were so significant, because there's some evidence that we're starting to see a weakening of the deep water circulation already. Now, just to get back to my general point, if we're looking at nonlinear change, then the adaptation problem becomes much more difficult for us, because we have to anticipate a whole range of possible sharp changes in the future that we can't possibly understand completely in the present. We have to plan for a range of possible alternatives. So the ingenuity requirement in the present is much higher. Rising frequency of extreme events. Even if we don't get a sudden shift in climate because of a reorganization of ocean currents, for example, we will still see a rising frequency of extreme events just because of the change in the frequency distribution of those events. So to explain this idea, think of, say, temperature in a place like Aspen. Temperature, you get a certain number of very hot days every year and a certain number of cool days, but temperature tends to average here, which might be, say, 10 degrees Celsius or something like that, and most of your days you'll get the highest frequency of days at the 10 degrees Celsius temperature. Now, if you shift, here you have, say, a very low frequency of hot days that might be 30 degrees Celsius. They might occur very infrequently. If you shift the frequency distribution to the right, even only moderately, say a change in the average of 5 or so degrees, you have a very significant shift in the distribution of events that previously occurred at the tail of the frequency distribution. So you can go from an event that might have occurred once a year to an event that occurs many times a year, say 10 or more times a year. You can change a 100-year event into an event that comes every 10 years. And that's simply because extreme events that are in the tail of the frequency distribution are highly sensitive to change in the mean of the frequency distribution. The final thing I want to say about the difficulty of the climate change problem is that climate change is not going to happen by itself. It's going to interact with other things, other stresses that are occurring around the world. And ultimately, the impact will be much larger as a result. So I call this the problem of negative synergy. And the example I use are the fires in California in October 2003, which you all remember probably very well. Now, this is a good example of a synergistic impact. Now, whether climate change was involved or not, we can't determine, because any particular drought or extreme event such as Katrina, you cannot in a causally deterministic way trace it back to climate change. But the drought that was seen in Southern California in the first part of the century was characteristic of the kinds of things we would expect to happen if global warming becomes severe. And it was a very severe drought, the worst in recorded history. At the same time, and partly as a consequence, one of the things that happened at that time was a beetle infestation in Southern California that is expected to eventually kill 90% of all the pine forests in Southern California. And some of you probably live in this area. This is in San Bernardino, and it's a photograph of pine trees that had died just 6 months before I was there. I was there in November 2003. And you remember the fires and the number of homes that were destroyed. 24 people lost their lives. Some 3,000 homes were destroyed. The cost was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $6 billion in total. And that event was a consequence of an interaction between the beetle infestation and drought and a particular pattern of social behavior, in this case, the tendency to build large numbers of houses in the interface zone between urban areas and forested areas, those edge zones. Very attractive places to live, but also ultimately when in a situation of climate change and consequential problems like beetle infestation, which probably was worse because of the weakened trees, because of the drought, you get a catastrophe as a result because you get a number of things interacting at the same time. So when we look at climate change, we mustn't think that this is just happening by itself. There are other things happening simultaneously. Water scarcities are developing in many places of the world because water is being overused. And the interaction, the consequence of those two things together, can ultimately be much greater than either one would be by itself.
Could I make a comment, please? Because I live there.
Yeah, sure.
Everything you said was right, but I think there are two facts that you didn't present, which you should. The first fact is that the state of California did not have the budget to do the fire clearance that they normally did. And in the newspaper reports at the time, that was a significant causal factor for the purposes of the results of the fire. The second thing was every one of those fires, the top one was the Santa Barbara Painted Cave fire, which is where I live.
Yep.
All were caused by human error.
But error happens in every system. There's those stochastic events in every system. The fact is that the system was poised at a point where it was extremely vulnerable.
You were talking causality.
Right.
I just think it was the same kind of balance.
Sure. I mean, but you could have had a lightning strike, too. But I think of the two points you just made, the one that is particularly significant is the fact that there wasn't a budget to clear the forest residue. But on the other hand, in many cases, people don't want intrusive intervention to clear the forest residue because it's in their backyards.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we can add a fourth factor then to my sequence of things that had to happen all together. Right, to produce. But the underlying point is that climate change will have its biggest impact in combination with other things that are happening around the world that are stressing our ecosystems and stressing our societies. And
this is just an example.
And this is an example of that.
It's just an example. He's not trying to link this to climate change.
Well, I know, but do you want an example that's a concentric circle narrowly focused? Or
let me finish with my four suggestions for what we can do, and then we'll open up the discussion. It looks like we're going to have a lot to talk about. Okay, so the third part of my talk, to get to some of the issues that the gentleman over there was hoping I would talk about, what kind of ingenuity can we generate and deliver now in response to this particularly difficult problem that has a very high ingenuity requirement? And I want to make four suggestions. Some of these will be familiar to you, but some we discuss less. The first I've already alluded to in part, and that is improving incentives within our markets for reduction in energy consumption and reduction in the release of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. In particular, the introduction of something like a carbon market, which is something that we're starting to see in Europe, but we haven't really seen in North America yet. We have a sulfur dioxide market. But if we can introduce what's called a cap and trade system, where there is a cap on the overall release of carbon dioxide established, and then individual agents such as companies or even people can trade rights to release carbon dioxide underneath that cap, then we will decentralize the problem-solving process. We'll get a lot of heads working on the problem all at the same time, and we'll increase the rate of innovation in ingenuity delivery. But this is a non-trivial problem, as they would have said at MIT when I was a graduate student there. There are a lot of things that have to be done, as the Europeans are discovering, to get a cap-and-trade system working. There's a lot of scientific research that is essential. For instance, decide what your cap is going to be. Are we going to try to cap global emissions at 450, 550, 650 parts per million? Recent research is suggesting that we should try, if we want to prevent a high likelihood of nonlinear climate change, we should try to limit the temperature increase on the planet to about 2 degrees Celsius, Remember, we're almost at 1 degree Celsius now, so we have about another 1 degree that we have of buffering capacity in there, which implies a total carbon dioxide loading in the atmosphere of about 450 parts per million. And to stabilize there at 450 parts per million, given the rapid development that we're seeing in India and China, and this is assuming that India and China are also in the cap-and-trade process, that we would have to reduce carbon emissions from our current rate in North America by 90%. It's a very, very demanding challenge. And that's if we take the level of 450 parts per million. Reductions don't have to be quite as significant if we assume that there's less sensitivity in the climate system and that we can go higher to, say, 550 parts per million. I would argue, though, for building, since we don't understand the climate system at all and we don't, for instance, understand where those thresholds are in the North Atlantic thermohaline circulation, I would argue for building in the levels lower rather than higher. I would argue for going for the 450 parts per million rather than 550 or higher. At the moment, it seems exceedingly unlikely that we're going to be able to limit our carbon dioxide output at that threshold because we're going to be there in about 30 or 40 years. The government has to be involved in deciding in financing not only the research that decides on these thresholds, but also for setting up a regulatory and financial system that will allow a cap-and-trade system to work. This includes things like monitoring of countries, companies, individuals, organizations, and their carbon dioxide output. This is going to be an astonishingly intrusive monitoring regime and technically very complex. It's going to require financing. If we want to do this on a global level, and ultimately it needs to be done on a global level, Kyoto is a terribly flawed agreement in part because it doesn't have China and India involved. And in that, I agree with George W. Bush. But if we're going to bring in developing countries, there have to be substantial financial arrangements to allow them to participate. We will probably need a new form of banking system at the global level to finance this. And we're going to have a whole set of institutions that will do things like establish the quality of tradable offsets. So, for instance, how many people here flew to get to this event? So probably about half the people here. And a certain number of you are from the community, but probably half the people here flew to get to this event. Now, airline travel adds somewhere between 2 and 3% to the total loading of carbon dioxide around the world every year. I'm starting to look in my own travel, I'm starting to look into the possibility of buying offsets, some kind of offsets that would allow me to have essentially carbon neutral travel. The problem is that there's a lot of fraud out there, to be blunt, when it comes to offsets. There are fly-by-night operations that will allow you to give them money and say, okay, I give you a certificate saying that we now planted a certain number of trees that absorb a certain amount of carbon dioxide, but either it never happens or it would have happened anyway. Establishing quality control measures for offsets is going to be very demanding and is going to require a regulatory apparatus. All of this is an immense ingenuity requirement. The second thing I think that we should be trying to do is introducing in a much more widespread way new forms we need to start developing new forms of centralized base power energy production. Regardless of what we do in our energy system in terms of renewables, especially distributed renewables, which I'll talk about in a moment, we're still going to have a significant residual need for centralized energy production for base electricity consumption in particular. Now, we have alternatives here. We have hydro, we have natural gas, and we have nuclear, but each of those faces significant problems. We've already built almost all the large hydro dams we can in North America, for instance, and we're actually starting to dismantle some of them now. Most of the good opportunities for hydropower production have already been taken. Natural gas production is dropping in North America, despite the fact that we're drilling a lot more. Between 2000 and 2005, the rate of drilling in the United States went up 60 to 70%, and production of natural gas declined 5%. Now, we may be able to bring natural gas for electricity production from Russia or from the Gulf or from the Caribbean, but it's going to be very expensive. Nuclear power is another possibility, and a lot of people are talking about a nuclear renaissance. My concern is that we still haven't figured out, although we might have figured out technologically, we haven't figured it out politically or socially what we're going to do with these wastes, which are piling up in swimming pools and storage facilities, some 70,000 tons of waste now in the United States. And this stuff is dangerous. It's extremely poisonous. It could be stolen and used by terrorists in a dirty bomb, a radiological device. And I'm not sure that we need a lot more of it sitting in relatively insecure locations around the world. So that... Can we let me finish, because I'm actually pretty close, and then we can have our conversation. So that leaves us with coal. And I don't like coming to this conclusion, but ultimately I think we're going to have to turn to coal in a big way. And it's going to involve coal gasification processes, new technologies that allow a coal plant to generate large quantities of electricity simultaneously with pure streams of hydrogen and carbon dioxide. And then the hydrogen can be used as a transportation fuel, and the carbon dioxide can be sequestered. It can be stored, for instance, geologically underground in abandoned oil and gas fields or in briny aquifers, hopefully in secure locations that will last for hundreds of millions of years. Now, this is a technology that's just being developed now. It's extremely important that we move this technology forward as fast as possible and then disseminate it around the world, because India and China are both going to go to coal in very large ways. China now imports 50% of its oil. In 15 years, it'll import 75% of its oil. Its coal consumption has increased 70% in the last 5 years. This is probably one of the major drivers now in the world of CO2 output. And China, in building its new energy infrastructure, each one of the plants of which lasts 50 to 60 years, needs to start introducing into that energy infrastructure CO2 sequestration as soon as possible. Okay, two more suggestions. Distributed renewables. We need to come at the energy problem from a lot of different directions, from multiple directions. And even with large-scale centralized production of electricity using coal, we can still probably reduce our energy consumption, especially at the household level, by somewhere between 30 and 50% without affecting our standard of living, by introducing a number of technologies for conservation and even for energy supply. Now, one that I like, we could talk about, for instance, distributed solar, distributed wind, even at the household level. But one that I particularly like, and I don't know how much it's considered in the States, is ground heat pumps. How many people here know about ground heat pumps? Okay, some of you do. So I'll just tell the story quickly. There's a great deal of low-quality heat in the ground underneath us, and even in places like Canada, you can extract that heat and use it to heat buildings quite effectively. You need high-quality energy in the form of electricity to drive your heat pumps, which are essentially reverse refrigerators. And then you drill wells into the ground, cycle a glycol fluid through those wells, and draw out some of the heat, and then concentrate it and distribute it through, for instance, your house. The problem with getting this technology widely used is not a technological one; it's a social and institutional one. It's about setting up the incentive arrangement within our economies so that people do this. The reason that you don't see a lot of people using this technology now is because the front-end costs are very high, somewhere in the neighborhood of $50,000 to $70,000 in Canada for a larger house. The way that can be solved, and one way it can be solved, is with a leasing arrangement so that a company comes in, installs the equipment, and then says, we will give you a 20% break on your heating bill, and we take all of the rest of the benefit that is achieved by installing this system. And over time, that system is amortized over perhaps a long period of time, in maybe 20 or 30 years or more. But they're fairly robust systems, and they last a long time. The problem here is making sure that the technology, the leasing arrangement, is transferred from one owner to another. And that's actually a relatively small legislative change, probably, and it's something that we're looking into introducing in Ontario. Then a person could go to a bank and say, okay, I want a loan. Actually, probably what would happen is a company would come to a person's door and say, would you like to save some money on your heating bill? And you say yes, and they would say, well, we're going to put these wells in your driveway and install a heat pump, and you will receive a 20% reduction in your heating bill on an annual basis. And all you have to do is sign this piece of paper that says you're going to, when you advertise this house, you're going to ensure that this lease is assigned to the next owner. Now, that's not a remarkably difficult change, probably, at least from the conversations I've had in Ontario. It's a social form of social ingenuity, and it could start an explosion of activity, of business, in this area of installing ground heat pumps. The reduction is quite significant. You get about a 75% reduction in your energy consumption when you install one of these systems in Ontario. Now, the last thing that I'd like to suggest that we should do is, I think, ultimately a lot more controversial, and this is about lifestyle and value changes. And this is where I part company with people like Amory Lovins. Amory Lovins will say, we don't want to talk about people changing their values. Instead, we want to hold those constant and see if we can maintain the current quality of life or even improve the current quality of life as defined according to certain values with better technologies of various kinds. And his institute has been very clever in working out how we could reduce our energy consumption by probably 50% or more by introducing purely technological solutions. But I don't think that we're going to get where we need to go by doing that solely. We're not going to, if we need to cap at 490 parts per million, we're not going to get there by introducing simply technological fixes. This is essentially a management approach to the problem, and instead we need to get deeper and we need to think about the values that are determining our lifestyles and consumption habits. Our values, most importantly, determine what we define as problems in our lives. And therefore, they really fundamentally influence our ingenuity requirement. A materially intensive lifestyle and values that support a materially intensive lifestyle requires an immense amount of a certain kind of ingenuity. If we're going to have 9 billion people on this planet, which is probably what our peak population will be in 2050 or 2060 or so, and we're going to support them all in a lifestyle such as we enjoy in North America right now, and with rising material expectations as we see in North America, where houses have increased substantially in size, about 25% in size on average over the last 30 years. We now have almost one car per person in North America, and we drive those cars 20% more than we did in the 1970s. And all of that, if we want to do that on a global basis, is going to require an enormous amount of institutional and technological ingenuity to support within ultimately a finite resource base. And that's even not thinking about the problem that Bill Clinton mentioned yesterday, which is probably within the next 20 years some kind of peak in the output of conventional oil. We need to get down to the issue of what ultimately makes our lives meaningful. And here I distinguish between three kinds of values: utilitarian, moral, and ethical values. So utilitarian values, moral and ethical values, and then finally what you could call perhaps existential or spiritual values. Utilitarian values are the kinds of values that dominate our economic discourse. Basically, this is about simple likes and dislikes. I like vanilla ice cream better than I like chocolate ice cream. Moral and ethical values are about what is fair and what is just between people, and ultimately, if you want to be expansive about it, between humans and other organisms, and what is fair in terms of the distribution of wealth and power and opportunities within our social systems. Existential and spiritual values are about what brings meaning into our lives. What are our ultimate ends? Why are we here? What is it what is our ultimate relationship to nature and to the cosmos? Now, these are questions that we recognize when we're young, and by the time we're 10 or 12 or so, and if we're still asking them, adults basically say, well, you shouldn't ask those because they're unanswerable questions. But there are these institutions that we call religious institutions, and you can go there to talk about things like that. But when you go into the door of your synagogue or your church or your mosque, you're not told how to think about these existential questions. You're told what to think. So the ultimate result is that when it comes to for things like moral and ethical values and spiritual and existential values, we are enormously impoverished in our ability to have a conversation about those things. And yet I think, and what happens because of that impoverishment is that the utilitarian discourse, the purely economic discourse, which tends to favor material consumption, in a sense fills up the space. It comes to dominate. Now, if the whole world emulates the Western materially and energy-intensive values and lifestyles, I don't think we have a hope of solving the climate change problem. It's game over. We won't be able to keep up with our soaring ingenuity requirement. At the moment, I don't think we're having a discussion about what kind of future we actually want for ourselves and for our children and our grandchildren. What kind of future will bring into the lives of our children meaning and a sense of purpose and a sense of potential and opportunity? My guess is that, and I have a 15-month-old child at home, my first. I've been thinking a lot about this recently, and my guess is that Ben and your children and your grandchildren would ultimately like to have more of what we see around us in this valley today and fewer of the endless material trappings of our high-consumption lifestyles. Okay, I'll take off my tie now, and we can go back to whatever issues you'd like to talk about.
And I'm going to sit down here. So why don't we just go around the room in this direction?
In the chart you showed about the thermohaline current, how close was the southern expulsion of heat into the atmosphere to Lake Bostock?
That's a good question. Not one I probably can't. I don't think I can answer. It's a long way. Antarctica is a big continent. So now you notice that there were three places where there was deep water formation. One, the most important is the one that I identified, that I pointed to, which is north of Iceland in the UK. Then there's another one off the coast of Labrador. And then there's ultimately the third that you noticed at the bottom near Antarctica. The one that, in my reading of the literature, is most important is the one that's furthest north. And if that changes, then you get a destabilization of the whole system. The Antarctic one is mentioned, but I haven't seen a specific analysis of it. But in any case, the heat release from that sinking of water is going to be a long way away from Antarctica. Now, just Antarctica is an interesting situation. Because of what skeptics say. Skeptics will often say, well, okay, we're seeing glaciers melt in some parts of the world, but Antarctica is actually seeing an increase in its total snow and ice mass. But that's not inconsistent with global warming, because you've got a wetter atmosphere, and in the interior of the continent where it's very cold, you get more snowfall. But if you look at the periphery of the continent, you're seeing very significant warming. And in the Antarctic Peninsula, which is the one that goes up to Chile and Argentina, that's the area of the world that's warming the second fastest after Alaska. Now, I guess I haven't seen anything that says that that's related to heat release from the water that's sinking in that area. The general consensus seems to be that that's a global warming phenomenon. You didn't put up your hand first, so now we're okay. Let's do this, but there are an awful lot of people. Let me go back and forth, and then everybody on this side will get a chance to. Is there anybody over here? Yeah.
This is not arguing that CO2 increases, that it's a question of the time slope. And some argue that the tremendous volcanic disruption that we had did wobble the Earth's orbit, which, you know, is the reason for the 12,000-year differences in climate. So the question of the slope, I think, is an argument, the time slope.
Well,
that's very important for time scale, because the ability to adjust and
right.
decrease and, CO2 is really dependent on the time slope.
I made that point, essentially. I said that the rate of change is the thing that really could cause problems for not just ourselves, but for other organisms and species on the planet. And even without nonlinear shifts, and there's an expectation now that we'll see at least some nonlinear shifts, but even without nonlinear shifts, the rate of warming is now very fast. Now, but you did mention something that I think is very important. There are going to be these other stochastic or random events in the system that we can't anticipate. There will be volcanic eruptions. There might be changes in solar output that will ultimately have a big effect on the rate of warming and may rescue us or may aggravate the situation. There are also a lot of things, a huge number of things that we simply don't understand about the climate system. I was reading some papers this morning about the situation in the Arctic. And in every second sentence, it seemed there was a statement to the effect that, well, we just don't know about this. We just don't know what the situation is. So, for instance, we can use satellite data to determine what the extent of the Arctic ice is. And we know that it's decreased about 20% in the last 30 years. But we don't know what the difference in the thickness of the ice is. We have some evidence from submarines that use upward scanning sonars. They've gone underneath and have bounced the sonar waves off the ice that suggests that there was a decrease of about a meter in thickness over a period of about 10 years between the 1980s and 1990s. Now, the Arctic ice is about, after that meter is gone, probably about 3 meters thick. But we don't know, because we don't have effective evidence. And it was pointed out in one of these articles that the satellite that was going to provide us with evidence on the thickness of Arctic ice was going to be sent up by the Europeans about 3 years ago, and it was on one of those rockets that blew up on launch. So here's a huge hole in our understanding. And whether we're talking about volcanoes or changes in solar output or changes in the thickness of Arctic ice, there are enormous numbers of things that we just don't understand, all of which I think ultimately argues for being safer, for playing it safer in terms of where we cap our ultimate carbon dioxide output rather than trying to push the system to the limit. Let's go back over here.
So we're talking about technologies to limit carbon dioxide to...
Is there a lot of things?
We've been talking about in all our seminars technologies on how to lower the output of carbon dioxide. Is there any, either through low-tech planting of trees or technology of extracting carbon dioxide
yes.
and storing it?
Yes. In fact, the coal gasification technology I was talking about could do that, because you don't have to just use coal. These are called zero-emission plants, and you can use any kind of organic material, corn husks, wood chips, straw, even municipal garbage, if it's stripped of all its non-organic content, and then you pour it into the plant, generate electricity, hydrogen, and carbon dioxide. You take the carbon dioxide and pump it underground. You're essentially taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere at that point.
Well, you're taking it out of the product that put it into the atmosphere.
Well, except let's...
I'm talking extracting it from the atmosphere.
Well, in a sense, this is an indirect extraction. It's an indirect extraction because for instance, you grow corn, right? You take all the corn husks. The corn absorbs carbon dioxide. You take the corn husks. You run them through this machine. You dump the carbon dioxide into the ground. You've essentially absorbed carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and put it underground. And that is the only feasible or plausible mechanism I've seen for large-scale removal of carbon dioxide. If you had a lot of these plants going around the world running on organic residues, then that would make a difference.
What about the greening of large areas of the
earth? I think we're going to have to go on. This fellow's been waiting quite a while. And they'll come back over here.
It's somewhat related to this question. If you were to compare the relative disadvantages of coal, using coal versus using nuclear. You have the CO2 problem and the
waste problem.
Waste problem, specifically. So if you were to consider those two as alternatives to our present fuel generation, which of those are more deleterious?
Well, interesting. It's a very good question, because notice the way immediately our values are implicated there, that we can't make that decision without making some assumptions about what kind of future we value. And it's a completely reasonable area for debate. Ontario has just made a decision to go nuclear in a big way. We're adding another 40 megawatts of nuclear over the next 30 or 40 years. And the problem there is I don't think there's been an adequate discussion of the long-term implications in terms of what kind of society we want. I would say that we're going to have some nuclear. Maybe even a significant slice of our energy production is going to be nuclear. But it should not be the wholesale solution to our problem. And the more general point here is that we're going to deal with the climate change problem and the related energy problem by taking slices off it. We're going to need a lot of different things to solve the problem. We need a little bit of a lot of conservation here, you know, new technologies at the household level and centralized energy, decentralized energy production. We're going to need probably some more nuclear. But on balance, of all of the large-scale centralized energy production technologies that I think are available, the one that offers, even though coal mining is incredibly messy, does huge environmental damage, and you know I don't want to go to coal, but the one that allows us to make perhaps the transition over the next 100 years before something like fusion comes online, and that leaves us with the most opportunities for the future and the least long-term costs is coal in this form, but only in this form. If we go to coal and don't have carbon sequestration, that actually is the worst outcome, which is really important at the back there.
You talk about carbon sequestration, and you mentioned two things. You mentioned putting it under, basically into the ground, and the oil industry has done that for a long time to try to extract more oil. But I've read reports that that doesn't really work very well because ultimately it leaks out. You may be thinking of 50 or 100 years, supposedly it does leak out. A whole alternative way of dealing with this is to basically pump it under the continental shelf. Your carbon dioxide, under conditions of low temperature and increased pressure, becomes liquid. And that technology is available today, and it's well within the capabilities of industry to drill to the depths that are required below the continental shelf to sequester this basically indefinitely.
Yeah. Now, I think I've read papers on both sides of the issue when it comes to land-based sequestration. You're quite right. We've been using carbon dioxide to enhance oil and gas production for quite some time, and it's been used in Saskatchewan, for instance, quite effectively. But my understanding is that if you go deeper and if you ensure that there's an impermeable layer of cap rock above it, and in many cases you might not be going into abandoned oil and gas fields at this point, you might be going to brining aquifers, that you can get long-term storage. This is a matter of, in a sense, urgent research necessity. We need to start investing significant resources in trying to understand what is possible here, and then if something is possible, identifying the places in the world where sequestration would make sense. And in terms of the continental shelf, I mean, people have talked about doing that. They've also talked about simply pumping it into the oceans very deep, too. There are a number of different possibilities here, but we're looking, ultimately, we want storage that's going to last not just a few hundred years, but for thousands, tens of thousands, even millions of years. And that's a research problem.
One other comment. There are some things that obviously we have no control over, volcanic activity and sunspots and things of that order. You did mention things that human beings are now doing that might adversely affect or positively affect. And I'm thinking specifically of the Three Gorges Dam, which has backed up such an enormous amount of water that it literally, and satellite images have shown this, have literally deflected and deformed the surface of the Earth, which could clearly change the rotational patterns or wobble of our planet.
Now, I have read about that, but
it's a very interesting phenomenon.
a more general issue, and Three Gorges will relate to this, is changes in the albedo of the planet, the reflectivity of the planet. And some of this we have a fair amount of control over. So we haven't given a lot of thought, for instance, to how we paint our roofs, what color we paint our roofs. If we paint them light colors as opposed to dark colors, we're going to not only reduce the heat island effect within our cities, but we will be effectively reducing the albedo of the planet, or increasing its reflectivity. And that is there's a whole range of things that we can do, some of which are really low tech, that can help us address this problem. But again, we have to come at it a slice at a time. There's no silver bullet here anymore. There's no one technology that's going to fix this. The rate of introduction of social ingenuity, yeah, is much lower than the rate of the problem becoming worse. You know, and I think, just to cut to the chase in my answer to your problem, when it comes to societies, you don't seem to get dramatic social innovation until there are shocks to the system, until there are significant and dramatic changes, in a sense, anomalies in the conventional understanding that challenge the conventional understanding that people just can't ignore anymore. Our capacity as a society is to, our inertia and our capacity to deny what seems to be utterly obvious is astonishing. In fact, in my latest book, I spend two chapters on the whole issue of denial, and it's not just a psychological process, it's a social process. And I don't think there are ultimately any really bad guys out there, but you have a lot of groups, and not just powerful corporations, but they can be unions, they can be, you know, teachers' associations, they can be government bureaucracies that have strong vested interests in the status quo. And the cumulative effect of the resistance of each one of these groups and organizations to large-scale change is that nothing ever gets done. And the only way you break through that is to have really shocking developments. And what we have to hope for, and this is where luck comes in, is that when the shocking developments happen, they happen in such a way that there's still a lot of residual adaptive capacity afterwards. In other words, they shock us, but they don't wreck us, so that we have the chance at that point to adapt. That it's not, and also we have to hope that when the shocks happen, even if they don't wreck us, it's not too late. One of the things about climate change that's really important is that there's a huge amount of inertia in the system. I talked about the effect of a current carbon dioxide that we put in the atmosphere not having its full impact on sea level rise for 1,000 years. So we're already building into the climate. We've probably already built in, by some people's assessments, at least another degree of warming. So we're already up close to 2 degrees Celsius, which is supposedly where we want to stop things. And if it's 30 years from now before we get a series of climate shocks that really make people think, wow, we have to do something about this problem, it's probably too late at that point. So we have to, in a sense, hope that, I'm not a terribly religious person, that God is on our side on this one. An interesting example is the ozone hole. We got the ozone hole over the Antarctic. If you wanted to have one place in the world where you got an ozone hole that would wake people up and galvanize action, it was over the Antarctic. And it was dramatic. It made people go, wow, look at that. We can do that. We can do things of that scale on the planetary level. We better do something about it. And we got very significant action on the CFC problem. Now, it's still going to take a century or more for that problem to correct itself, according to the latest evidence. But that was a shock to the system that really woke people up. Now, the climate change problem is much harder. You know, with ozone, we had 6 companies that were producing most of the CFCs. You could get the 6 companies in a room like this and have a discussion. With energy, it implicates every single group and individual, powerful and not powerful, within our societies. And so the negotiation is much more difficult, and the capacity for collections of those groups to hobble any progress is much higher. So ultimately, I think the shock to the system that's going to galvanize us will have to be much larger. So, I sometimes jokingly say, you know, what we need is a Category 5 storm to hit Washington, D.C.
You know. Hit Katrina.
But Katrina, no, but you know what's interesting? I think actually Katrina on a global level may have had a significant effect psychologically. that it actually started to make people think, wow, this could actually do a lot of damage. Now, I don't know if it's the kind of shock that I'm talking about, significantly large, but it's certainly the connection between Katrina and global warming in the scientific evidence is by no means clear, but it's not negligible. The Gulf at the time that Katrina was moving across it was the highest temperature it had ever been. And now there are debates about whether that's a result of global warming or not, but people, the lay understanding is actually pretty accurate of this. You know, that seems like there might be a relationship there, and I think it did shift.
So we need an enemy to galvanize human ingenuity.
Well, we need anomalous evidence.
We need a shock. We need a revolution to create evolution. Is there no case in history where, I mean, I think that this CFC
was
an evolutionary.
Well, it was actually, the change was very fast. It was almost revolutionary when it happened. I mean, the decision was reached very quickly on CFCs. Let's go over here. And then let's take the last two here.
Stay on the same trend. Since, as a social situation, because using your ingenuity, you know, humans are taking disorder and creating order. And in this particular case, I agree with you that it's going to take a shock to create change. But it seems to me, in this case, as opposed to the one you're talking about, fluorocarbons.
Yep.
We have a situation where the carbon emissions are centralized, but there are large organizations that are behind that. In particular, we have one, China, which is moving a billion people in one almost single direction. So it seems to me that my question to you is when you look at this, it seems to me we're going to get a shock. The question is the relaxation time, and maybe the organizing principle is that we organize societies around the planet to fight this, because it's only when we change our organizing principle, which currently is still to maintain and fight a war, that's how we're organized in this society. So the question here is, how do we get to not only our country, if we change, but to others to change their organizing principles so they're organized to deal with this? Because that's probably it seems to me that we're going to have a shock. It's going to be a situation. And our new organizing principle will be not who is going to get the most resources on the planet to build their infrastructure.
It might be a military one.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it's a good question. I don't think it's just about how we organize ourselves. I also think it's about what kind of values we're using to guide our.
Well, that would be part.
And that's in almost foundational in a way. And I think what's happening in, you know, China is replicating the Western model almost 100%. And even down to the dirty industrialization process. Everybody was saying, well, you know, these newly developing countries can at least skip the dirty industrialization process. But China's industrialization process is stunningly dirty. You know, they're ruining their environment to the extent that it now costs them probably close to 20% of their GDP on an annual basis. I think, you know, you're actually pointing at the central issue I address in the book I just handed in on Friday to my publisher, which is, okay, when the shocks happen, because I think there will be shocks, and let's hope they aren't so severe that they wreck our capacity to respond, what are we going to do? And organizing ourselves to do something constructive is a challenge for now, not for the moment when the shock happens.
Exactly.
And that's the question I ask. Now, how we organize ourselves is a question I can't answer myself. But I think I think the way we think about it is exactly like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
The shock, you know, all of us, I think, don't need more shocks. I think we've got it to the real action and reaction and co-action, that we could galvanize our young people's imagination, because we can't leave them with so that the problem is so big, and that they're the people who inherited all the mistakes of the people come before them to a point where they are completely unable to respond. And so I was actually looking to see, you know, what are some of the examples of effective response across sectors. So by the way, I just want to give a few examples. A few years ago, this whole thing about a carbon footprint, nobody refers to that. But if you look at campus now and through some of the BP commercials on TV, they talk about, do you have a neutral carbon footprint? To the point that that term is in people's consciousness now. It's not far enough yet, but you know, it's great. I found it particularly sort of interesting that the Western governors, the governors of the Western state, who actually gathered together and say, we need to take more actions in this whole area of environmental responses than what the federal government has said to them, that we need to actually go beyond that. And I thought, my gosh, is that reflecting a change in consciousness of not two governors, but what, 11 or 12 governors? And, you know, and so, and there are institutions. So, Professor, I think the challenge for us in particular is to think through how to break through the inertia in response, not on a macro level, but just sufficiently in terms of clusters of cross-sector responses. You know, if you look at engineering, there's a lot of work now on sort of the green design and institutional work. We've looked at energy countries where some are moving forward to see. You know, I think, for example, the example of Brazil, well, somehow along the way, they learned to use ethanol to the point that they could reduce their independence. And I'm not saying that that is a solution for us, but it's a wake-up call that somebody responded early enough to the point. So it is a challenge to us to say, what didn't you do, and what could you do now? So I just want, someday perhaps, next, is to really focus on the social ingenuity part of it. Because I think this is what we owe the next generation. It's beyond telling them what is the damage that we have done for them, but it's to say, this is also sort of the beginning, I think it's 10, 20 years, of sort of institutional capacity building that we are evolving to address these issues. Is it close to the task which is needed? Not at all. But we need to focus their energy on sort of these things.
Let me just say something quickly about this, and then I guess we'll wrap up for the day. Some of the suggestions I was making are, in a sense, cluster-based. They can be implemented locally or regionally and may have a significant impact on carbon dioxide output in those areas. So something like these ground heat pumps would make a significant difference for space heating. What's happening with the governors is terrific. Concern about Colorado River flow is a big motivator. Concern about agricultural economies is a big motivator. Some people see the writing on the wall. The problem, I think, is that all of these small and regional changes that are wonderful in themselves, when you add them all up, aren't getting us even close to where we need to go. And the longer we wait, the less feasible it is that ground-level activities and clusters of activities are going to make a sufficient difference to really solve the problem. Now, if we had started with the kind of stuff you're talking about 3 decades ago, and we started with it around the world, we'd be way better off than we are right now. But it's just starting now, very late in the day, and we don't have support from the administration of the most powerful country in the world and the country that's releasing the most carbon dioxide in the world. So there's nothing coming from the top. What we need, and what perhaps some kind of shock to the system would achieve, is a kind of release of ingenuity, not only at the ground level where you're seeing some of it now, not a huge amount, but at least some of it, but also from the top. We need to regard this as a planetary emergency, and we're not thinking about it in those terms yet. This is, as I said at the beginning of my presentation, the biggest challenge the human species may ever face. And we're very, very close in terms of the lifespan of the human species, which is 100,000 to 300,000 years, if you, depending on how you think about it, we're very close, maybe within 10, 20, 30 years to losing the game before we've even realized it's really started. And the longer we wait, the more it's going to require national or global mobilization to solve the problem. And the local level stuff just won't help very much anymore.
But I'm not asking us to wait. But I'm saying that if the discussion ends with sort of the severity of the problem, and sort of always ends on a tone of sort of like, this problem is bigger than us. And by the way, don't disagree with anything you have said. But I'm just concerned, you know, you're seeing situations where people are in so much trauma that they're just, they've lost the sparkle. They just accept the reality that this is a hopeless situation. And that's just, I don't want our conversations to end at that level. I just want it to continue.
Okay. Well, in that case, we'll end with you, and then it continues. Thank you very much. Thank you.